forces. Then simple hydrogen coalescing into a star. Then matter transformed by gravity and nuclear processes. Then a stone on Earth. Finally, something transformed by man, with a still uncompleted and equally extensive developmental history before it. This transformation of the object is temporality itself, the manifestation of Tao, the flux of being. The capacity of human beings to apprehend variable spatial-temporal spans turns the object into something more complex than its mere present appearance. This increase in complexity is compounded by the extended active capacity for exploration, also typical of our species. What is an iron block for man? Shaped, a spear, and therefore food and death and security. Suspended, a pendulum, key to detection of the Earth's rotation. Dropped, significant of gravity. Reduced to its constituent particles with sufficient patience and ingenuity, representative of molecular and atomic structure, a part like the whole. The question might be more accurately presented. What is an iron block not for man? The pre-experimental mind of the alchemist, pondering the nature of the prima materia, the fundamental constituent element of experience, easily became possessed by intimations of the infinite possibility of matter, of the boundless significance of the finite object, of the endless utility of the object and its inexhaustible capacity to reveal, become, the unknown. When an object is explored, its motivational significance is constrained, generally as a consequence of the specific goal-directed nature of the exploratory process, inevitably predicated upon a specific hypothesis. Is this thing good for a particular function, but not for any number of other potential functions? The question in mind, implicit or explicitly formulated, determines in part the answer given by the object. The object is always capable of superseding the constraint in some unpredictable fashion. This infinite potential finds its symbolic expression in the self-devouring serpent, the mercurial spirit of transformation, the spirit that draws interest inexorably to itself. While considering these ideas, I dreamed that a small object was traveling above the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. It moved along in the center of a procession of four immense hurricanes, configured as a square divided into quadrants, one hurricane per quadrant, tracked by satellites, monitored carefully and apprehensively by scientists manning the latest in meteorological equipment in stations all over the world. The dream scene shifted. The object, a sphere of about 8 inches in diameter, was now contained and exhibited in a small glass display case like that found in a museum. The case itself was in a small room with no visible exit or entry points. The American president, symbol of social order, and the crippled physicist Stephen Hawking, representative of scientific knowledge and of disembodied rationality, were in the room with the object. One of them described the features of the room. Its walls were 7 feet thick and made of some impervious substance, titanium dioxide, which sounded impressive in the context of the dream. These walls were designed to permanently contain the object. I wasn't in the room, although I was there as an observer, like the audience in a movie. The object in the display case appeared alive. It was moving and distorting its shape, like a chrysalis or a cocoon in its later stages of development. At one point, it transformed itself into something resembling a meerschaum pipe. Then it reformed itself into a sphere and shot out through one wall of the case and the room, leaving two perfectly round, smooth holes, one in the case and the other in the wall. It left with no effort whatsoever, as if the barriers designed to restrain its movement were of no consequence once the decision had been made. The object was an image of God, the Uroboric serpent embodied in matter, powerful enough to require the accompaniment of four hurricanes as attendants. The room was a classification system, something designed by the most powerful representatives of the social and scientific worlds to constrain the mysterious phenomenon. The object transformed itself into a pipe in reference to the famous painting by Magritte of a pipe, entitled, in translation, "This is not a pipe." The map is not the territory. The representation, not the phenomenon. The capacity of the object to escape, at will, referred to the eternal transcendence of the phenomenal world, of its infinite capacity to unexpectedly supersede its representation, scientific and mythic. I dreamed much later, perhaps after a year, of a man suspended, equidistant from the floor, ceiling, and walls in a cubic room, about arm's length from each. The surfaces of the cube curved inward toward the man, as if the room was constructed of the intersection of six spheres. All surfaces of the cube remained at the same distance from the man, regardless of his pattern of movement. If he walked forward, the cube moved forward with him. If he walked backward, the cube moved backward at precisely the same rate, with no discontinuity whatsoever. The surfaces themselves were covered with circular patterns about 4 inches in diameter, inscribed within squares of about the same size. Out of the center of each circle dangled the tip of a reptile's tail. The man could reach in any direction, grasp a tail, and pull it out of the surface into the room. This dream referred to the capacity of man to voluntarily pull the future into the present. The serpent, evident only in the form of his tail, was the Ouroboros, embedded implicitly in the phenomenal world. The potential for the emergence of something new was present in every direction the man could look inside the cube. He could determine what aspect of being would reveal itself as a consequence of his voluntary action. The act of exploration produces / elicits discriminable phenomena. These phenomena are mapped by the episodic and semantic memory systems. The exploratory process, however, is guided by the maps produced by the episodic system, particularly by its maps of the future. A desired end is posited in fantasy. The motoric abstract exploration system endeavors to bring about a match between emergent phenomena produced in the course of activity and that map of the desired future. Mismatches between production and goal elicit reappearance of the base matter of the world, the unknown, manifest in negative affect and curiosity. The individual attempts to transform his wishes, rooted in the final analysis in emotion, into reality, suffering and learning when that process is disrupted. Exploration is deemed sufficient and may justly come to an end when the current affective state is deemed optimal, when knowledge, translated into action, has adjusted the world such that it is once again paradisal. In the absence of such a paradisal state, in the absence of current security, happiness, exploration is or has been, by definition, incomplete. The residual mysteries that still accompany current being, which manifest themselves in the intrinsic attractiveness of the thing or situation, must therefore become the focus of active attention so that the information embedded in them can be pulled out and transformed into subjective being and the world. The alchemical base matter of the world was, therefore, the stuff of which determinate experience, subject and object, was made, was something in addition capable of endless transformation, was something finally corrupt, as the material world was corrupt, incomplete, unrealized, fallen, and suffering. Analysis of the pre-experimental category of gold helps shed light on the relevance, importance, and meaning of this archaic complex of undiscriminated ideas. Gold, as ultimate contrast to mere base matter, was the ideal as it could be perceived in the concrete world. For the pre-experimental man, as well as for the modern, gold served as a medium of economic exchange. But the value of the metal did not, and still does not, consist solely in its economic utility. Gold has always been associated, in episodic representation, with divinity. Prior to development of the scientific worldview, this association made perfect sense. Gold, in contrast to lesser metals or substances, does not tarnish, dull, or rust. It therefore appears imperishable, immortal, and incorruptible. Gold is rare rather than common. It shines like the sun, the evident source of life. The category of gold therefore tended to subsume everything Apollonian, sun-like, divine, in the patriarchal slash heroic sense we have become familiar with. Jung describes the characteristic presumptions of the alchemist Michael Meyer. The sun, by its many millions of revolutions, spins the gold into the earth. Little by little, the sun has imprinted its image on the earth, and that image is the gold. The sun is the image of God. The heart is the sun's image in man, just as gold is the sun's image in the earth, and God is known in the gold. The light of the sun is a symbol of power and the transcendence of clarity and consciousness, of heroism and permanence, and of victory over the forces of darkness, disintegration, and decay. The earliest patriarchal gods and leaders of men combined the life-giving attributes of the sun with the heroic ideals of man, and the coins that bore their likeness were round and golden in imitation of the solar disk. Gold was, furthermore, the ideal end toward which all ores progressed, was the target of material progression. As it ripened in the womb of the earth, lead, for example, base and promiscuous, willing to mate, combine with many other substances, aimed at the state characterized by gold, perfect and inviolable. This made the gold state the goal of the mercurial spirit of the unknown embedded in matter. Mircea Eliade states, "If nothing impedes the process of gestation, all ores will, in time, become gold. If there were no exterior obstacles to the execution of her designs," wrote a Western alchemist, "nature would always complete what she wished to produce." That is why we have to look upon the births of imperfect metals as we would on abortions and freaks, which come about only because nature has been, as it were, misdirected, or because she has encountered some fettering resistance. Belief in the natural metamorphosis of metals is of very ancient origin in China, and is also found in Annam, in India, and in the Indian archipelago. The peasants of Tonkin have a saying, "Black bronze is the mother of gold." Gold is engendered naturally by bronze, but this transmutation can materialize only if the bronze has lain a sufficiently long period in the bosom of the earth. The alchemist viewed himself as midwife to nature, bringing to fruition what nature endeavored slowly to produce, and therefore as aid to a transformation aimed at producing something ideal. Gold is that ideal. Eliade continues, "The nobility of gold is thus the fruit at its most mature. The other metals are common because they are crude, not ripe." In other words, nature's final goal is the completion of the mineral kingdom, its ultimate maturation. The natural transmutation of metals into gold is inscribed in their destiny. The tendency of nature is to perfection. But since gold is the bearer of a highly spiritual symbolism, gold is immortality, say the Indian texts repeatedly, it is obvious that a new idea is coming into being. The idea of the part assumed by the alchemist as the brotherly savior of nature. He assists nature to fulfill her final goal, to attain her ideal, which is the perfection of its progeny, be it mineral, animal, or human, to its supreme ripening, which is absolute immortality and liberty. The alchemists lived in a world that had theoretically been redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ, at least from the Christian perspective, but they did not feel at all redeemed. They remained unsatisfied with the present, still too mortal condition. So, they turned their attention to those aspects of the world that had been defined in accordance with prevailing morality as unworthy of examination, as corrupt and contemptible. Presuming, or hoping, that things might yet be better, they explored, as we explore now, hoping to extract from the unknown new and useful tools. The alchemists assumed implicitly that further exploration might bring redemptive knowledge. This search was driven by their admission of the unbearable present, by their identification with a still fallen world. The alchemists believed that the desirable transmutation of matter could be brought about by the release of Mercurius from matter. This meant that they implicitly recognized that interest-guided exploration was key to the redemptive expansion of being. In participating in this process, the alchemists identified with the exploratory hero and turned themselves unconsciously, that is, in procedure, if not always in representation, into that which redeems. This identification was complicated by the fact that the alchemist also considered himself as partaking of the state of matter, as belonging in the state necessitating redemption. This basically meant that the alchemist viewed himself, at least in part, as occupying the same category as matter, as well as being that which could become gold and which could aid in that transformation. For the pre-experimental mind, with its more general and conflated categories, there is no necessary distinction between the thing being acted on and the thing doing the acting. Iliada describes, for example, the sympathetic magic necessary to complete a grafting operation between two different species of plants, to induce unlike to mate with unlike from a broader perspective. Ibn Washia, and he is not the only Oriental writer to allow himself to be carried away by such images, speaks of fantastic graftings, contrary to nature, between differing vegetable species. He says, for instance, that the grafting of a branch of a lemon tree onto a laurel or olive tree would produce very small lemons, the size of olives. But he makes it clear that the graft could succeed only if it was performed in the ritual manner and at a certain conjunction of the sun and moon. He explains the rite thus. The branch to be grafted must be held in the hands of a very beautiful maiden, while a man is having shameful and unnatural sexual intercourse with her. During coitus, the girl grafts the branch onto the tree. The significance is clear. In order to ensure an unnatural union in the vegetable world, an unnatural sexual union between human beings was necessary. Such ideas are far from rare. Virtually every process undertaken by pre-experimental individuals, from agriculture to metallurgy, was accompanied by rituals designed to bring about the state of mind or illustrate the procedure necessary to the successful outcome desired. This is because the action precedes the idea. So, ritual sexual unions accompanied sowing of the earth, and sacrificial rituals and their like abounded among miners, smiths, and potters. Nature had to be shown what to do, man led, not least, by example. The correct procedure could only be brought about by those who had placed themselves in the correct state of mind. This idea was taken to its logical conclusion during the alchemical procedure, which had as its fantastical end state or desired future the most profound and far-reaching notion of transformation ever conceptualized, the final perfection or redemption of matter. To induce disparate elements to combine harmoniously in the production of the lapis philosophorum, that which will transmute base metals into gold, it was necessary to become unified oneself. To engender perfection from nature, therefore, man had to become perfect. The necessity for the perfection of the alchemist and the relation of the alchemical procedure to his own being was further strengthened by the alchemist's identity with the material world, that is, by his occupation of the same categorical space as matter. Man, a fallen, corrupt, material being, yet capable of endless transformation, partook of the essence of the fallen, corrupt, yet transformable material world. Those things relevant to the transformation of the being of objects were therefore also, by logical necessity, relevant to the transformation of his own being. The transformation of base matter into gold, writ large, was the redemption of the world, its transformation into the state of gold. The lapis philosophorum was means to that end. This extension of the theories of sympathetic magic to the domain of chemistry meant that alchemy became increasingly rife with primarily imagistic speculation regarding the nature of perfection as it developed over the centuries. It is difficult for moderns to realize why any of this might be relevant. Our psychology and psychiatry, our sciences of the mind, are devoted, at least in theory, to empirical evaluation and treatment of mental disorders. But this is mostly smoke and screen. We are aiming always at an ideal. We currently prefer to leave the nature of that ideal implicit, because that helps us sidestep any number of issues that would immediately become of overwhelming difficulty if they were clearly apprehended. So, we define health as that state consisting of an absence of diseases or disorders and leave it at that, as if the notion of disease or disorder or of the absence thereof is not by necessity a medieval concatenation of moral philosophy and empirical description. It is our implicit theory that a state of non-anxiety is possible, however, and desirable, that leads us to define dominance by that state as disordered. The same might be said for depression, for schizophrenia, for personality disorders, and so on. Lurking in the background is an implicit, that is, unconscious, ideal against which all insufficient present states are necessarily and detrimentally compared. We do not know how to make that ideal explicit, either methodologically or practically, that is, without causing immense dissent in the ranks. We know, however, that we must have a concept of not ideal in order to begin and to justify necessary treatment. Sooner or later, however, we will have to come to terms with the fact that we are in fact attempting to produce the ideal man, and will have to define explicitly what that means. It would be surprising indeed if the ideal we come to posit bore no relationship to those constructed painstakingly over the course of centuries of effort in the past. Something very similar happened in the case of alchemy, at least in the West. As the philosophy developed through the Christian era, the lapis was increasingly identified with Christ. There is no reason to presume that this came as anything but a surprise to the alchemists themselves. We are in for a shock, at least as great. To perfect nature, it was necessary to harbor the correct attitude, to undertake the appropriate rituals and processes of spiritual purification, to become purer as the thing desired. The worker stood as example to nature in small things and great. In the case of alchemy, which ambitiously desired to redeem the fallen material world, the alchemist himself had to become great. Thus, the alchemical literature might be regarded, in part, as one long meditation on the nature of the ideal man. Episodic representation in medieval Christendom. Science is predicated upon the axiomatic presupposition that it is worthwhile to analyze the material or collectively apprehensible sensory world and its transformations. This belief, which first manifested itself in alchemical fantasy, is so much a part of the modern world, so much its primary assumption, that it is difficult to realize what a remarkable achievement its formalization represented. It took thousands of years of cultural development to formulate the twin notions that empirical reality existed, independent of the motivational significance of things, and that it should be systematically studied. And these ideas only emerged initially in the complex societies of the Orient and Europe. The alchemists were the first to risk this attribution or something similar to it, but they still studied matter in the absence of explicit empirical methodology. Jung states, "The concept of the psychic, as we understand it today, did not exist in the Middle Ages, and even the educated modern man finds it difficult to understand what is meant by reality of the psyche. So, it is not surprising that it was incomparably more difficult for medieval man to imagine something between esse in re and esse in intellectu solo. The way out lay in metaphysics. The alchemist was therefore compelled to formulate his quasi-chemical facts metaphysically, too. The lack of scientific methodology, the inability to conduct formalized comparison of behavior-predicated experience to determine its generalizability, meant the inextricable admixture of the purely sensory and the subjective, affective, mythological aspects of experience. The purpose of scientific methodology is, in large part, to separate the empirical facts from the motivational presumption. In the absence of such methodology, the intermingling of the two domains is inevitable. As von Franz points out, the alchemists believed that they were studying the unknown phenomenon of matter, and they just observed what came up and interpreted that somehow, but without any specific plan. There would be a lump of some strange matter, but as they did not know what it was, they conjectured something or other, which of course would be unconscious projection, but there was no definite intention or tradition. Therefore, one could say that in alchemy, projections were made, hypotheses were generated, most naively and unprogrammatically, and completely uncorrected. Imagine an old alchemist's situation. A man in a certain village would build an isolated hut and cook things, which caused explosions. Quite naturally, everyone calls him a witch doctor. One day someone comes and says he has found a queer piece of metal, and would the alchemist be interested in buying it? The alchemist does not know the value of the metal, but gives the man some money at a guess. He then puts what has been brought him in his stove and mixes it with sulfur or something similar to see what happens, and if the metal was lead, he would be badly poisoned by the vapors. He concludes, therefore, that this particular matter makes one feel sick if approached and nearly kills you, and therefore he says that there is a demon in lead. Afterwards, when he writes his recipes, he adds a footnote saying, "Beware of lead, for in it is a demon which will kill people and make them mad," which would be quite an obvious and reasonable explanation for someone of that time and level. Therefore, lead was a wonderful subject for the projection of destructive factors, since in certain connections its effects are poisonous. Acid substances were also dangerous, but, on the other hand, being corrosive and a means of dissolving things, were highly important for chemical operations. Thus, if you wish to melt something or have it in liquid form, it could be melted or dissolved in acid solutions, And for this reason, the projection was that acid was the dangerous substance which dissolves, but which also makes it possible to handle certain substances. Or else it is a medium of transformation. You open up, so to speak, a metal with which you can do nothing and make it accessible to transformation by the use of certain liquids. The alchemists therefore wrote about it in the naive form which I am now describing and did not notice that that was not natural science, but contained a lot of projection if looked at from a modern chemical standpoint. Thus, there exists in alchemy an astonishing amount of material from the unconscious, produced in a situation where the conscious mind did not follow a definite program, but only searched. Alchemy flourished for almost 2,000 years and only faded from view in the late 18th century. It developed, at least in the Middle Ages, as a movement compensating that embodied in absolutist Christianity, which emphasized the ultimate reality and value of the spirit, dogmatically concretized, which presumed that everything worth knowing had already been discovered, and which cast the material world into disrepute. For the medieval mind, the body, the sensory, physical world, matter in general, was valued as immoral and as corrupt, as ruled by demonic, unknown forces. The story of Genesis, serpent and Eve conspiring to bring about the descent of mankind into the profane and fallen material world, in part provided the mythological basis for this union of category. The attractions of the material world also posed a threat to identification with the church, as the pull of sensuality, for example, or the desire for material instead of spiritual wealth. Furthermore, the fact of the fallen material state undermined faith in church dogma. Apprehension of the unresolved suffering of man made it difficult to attribute to Christ's actions the final state of redemption they theoretically guaranteed. In consequence, contact with the matriarchal underworld of matter, that is, with the unknown, seemed very threatening to the church authorities, and for very good reason, at least from the perspectives of conservation and tradition. Alchemical fascination with matter developed antithetically to the early Christian valuation of the spiritual and the established, developed as an antithesis to the domain of the known. The suppression of the sensory material world by the church and the simultaneous establishment of an absolute body of knowledge meant rejection or denial of anomalous sensory/emotional experience and therefore of the value contained in such experience. Alchemical preoccupation with matter arose as a consequence of this lost value asserting itself, in the attraction of the accumulated, rejected, and unknown, in the inevitable attraction of the forbidden fruit. Observing what he did not understand, the alchemist had recourse only to speculation, which he used to interpret that unknown. These speculations look like fantasies to the modern mind, like the fantasies of the medieval Christian, and pre-Christian in some cases. Jung states, "So, in a sense, they are, and for this reason, they lend themselves to decipherment by the method of complex psychology. The alchemical approach is so patently a spiritual and moral attitude that one cannot doubt its psychological nature. To our way of thinking, this immediately sets up a dividing wall between the psychic and the chemical process. For us, the two things are incommensurable. But they were not so for the medieval mind. It knew nothing of the nature of chemical substances and their combination. It saw only enigmatic substances which, united with one another, inexplicably brought forth equally mysterious new substances. In this profound darkness, the alchemist's fantasy had free play and could playfully combine the most inconceivable things. It could act without restraint and, in doing so, portray itself without being aware of what was happening." The alchemist thought in a medieval or pre-medieval fashion, using archaic preconceptions and ideas. Analysis of that thought, projected upon matter, just as we interpret matter in the light of our own current and therefore invisible theories, therefore means interpretation of fantasy, analysis of the spontaneous productions of the exploring mind. Such analysis means increased capacity to understand the workings of mind. The entire corpus of alchemy contains 1,700 years of fantasy regarding the nature of moral transformation, assumed to take place in matter, a category that included man, striving as it did naturally toward perfection. Central to this movement toward perfection was the dissolution, transformation, and reconstitution of unredeemed primal matter, the prima materia. Jung comments, as is indicated by the very name which he chose for it, the spagyric art, or by the oft-repeated saying, solve et coagula, dissolve and reconstitute, the alchemist saw the essence of his art in separation and analysis on the one hand, and synthesis and consolidation on the other. For him, there was first of all an initial state in which opposite tendencies or forces were in conflict. Secondly, there was the great question of a procedure which would be capable of bringing the hostile elements and qualities, once they were separated, back to unity again. The initial state, named the chaos, was not given from the start, but had to be sought for as the prima materia. And, just as the beginning of the work was not self-evident, so to an even greater degree was its end. There are countless speculations on the nature of the end state, all of them reflected in its designations. The commonest are the ideas of its permanence, prolongation of life, immortality, uncorruptibility, its androgyny, its spirituality and corporeality, its human qualities and resemblance to man, homunculus, and its divinity. The alchemists began their work, their opus, by determining to face the unknown, locked away in the material world, in the pursuit of an ideal. Their ideal was symbolized by the lapis philosophorum, which was a unitary substance characterized by its ability to transform base metals into gold and more, which could confer upon its bearer complete knowledge, immortal life, and impeccable mental and physical health. The medieval individual had no idea that the creation of such a substance was not possible, and was aware of many substances that had transformative properties. Identification of what motivated such a pursuit appears straightforward. There were undoubtedly many who tried their hand at alchemy purely for its potential economic benefit, just as there are many today who pursue their occupation solely for material gain. Even this is a form of desire for redemption, however, through material means, and may be unexpectedly transformed into a more purely spiritual pursuit in the course of maturation or through the unpredictable actions of fantasy and circumstance. There were also alchemists who more clearly embodied the spirit of devout curiosity and who worked with the same serious discipline as the later natural scientist. It is naive to underestimate the power and the mystery of the fantasy of the philosopher's stone. This idea provided the motive power underlying disciplined investigation into the secrets of matter, a difficult, painstaking, expensive procedure. The idea that matter contained within it the secret to wisdom, health, and wealth underlies the entire opus of modern science. The fact that such an idea could arise and be seriously entertained in spite of grandiosity and conflict with church dogma is difficult enough to believe. It becomes truly incomprehensible when consideration is given to the additional fact that the procedure extended over 17 centuries, despite the fact that no alchemist ever reached his goal. Jung observes, in view of the fact that a miracle never did occur in the retort, despite repeated assertions that someone had actually succeeded in making gold, and that neither a panacea nor an elixir has demonstrably prolonged a human life beyond its due, and that no homunculus has ever flown out of the furnace. In view of this totally negative result, we must ask on what the enthusiasm and infatuation of the adepts could possibly have been based. In order to answer this difficult question, one must bear in mind that the alchemists, guided by their keenness for research, were in fact on a hopeful path, since the fruit that alchemy bore after centuries of endeavor was chemistry and its staggering discoveries. The emotional dynamism of alchemy is largely explained by a premonition of these then unheard-of possibilities. However barren of useful or even enlightening results its labors were, these efforts, notwithstanding their chronic failure, seem to have had a psychic effect of a positive nature, something akin to satisfaction or even a perceptible increase in wisdom. Otherwise, it would be impossible to explain why the alchemists did not turn away in disgust from their almost invariably futile projects. The alchemical fantasy provided, and still provides, the motive power for the empirical endeavor, just as the dream of Judeo-Christianity provided motive power for the civilization of the West. In this manner, myth, mysterious, absurd, and incomprehensible, stands at the vanguard of the adaptive process. Mircea Eliade states, with specific regard to the origin of science, "Until recently, few were aware of Isaac Newton's role in this general alchemical movement, whose goal was the renovatio of European religion and culture by means of an audacious synthesis of the occult traditions and the natural sciences. It is true that Newton never published the results of his alchemical experiments, although he declared that some of them were crowned with success. His innumerable alchemical manuscripts, ignored until 1940, have recently been meticulously analyzed by Betty Jo Teeter Dobbs in her book, The Foundations of Newton's Alchemy. Dobbs affirms that Newton experimented in his laboratory with the operations described in the immense alchemical literature, probing the latter as it has never been probed before or since. With the aid of alchemy, Newton hoped to discover the structure of the micro-universe in order to homologize it with his cosmological system. The discovery of gravity, the force which keeps the planets in their orbits, did not completely satisfy him. But although he pursued the experiments indefatigably from 1669 to 1696, he did not succeed in identifying the forces which govern the corpuscles. Nevertheless, when he began to study the dynamics of orbital movement in 1679 to 80, he applied his chemical conceptions of attraction to the universe. As Maguire and Ratanzi have shown, Newton was convinced that in the beginning, God had imparted the secrets of natural philosophy and of true religion to a select few. The knowledge was subsequently lost, but partially recovered later, at which time it was incorporated in fables and mythic formulations where it would remain hidden from the vulgar. In modern days, it could be more fully recovered from experience. For this reason, Newton examined the most esoteric sections of the alchemical literature, hoping that they would contain the true secrets. It is significant that the founder of modern mechanics did not reject the tradition of a primordial and secret revelation, just as he did not reject the principle of transmutation. As he wrote in his Optics, 1704, "The change of bodies into light and of light into bodies is entirely in conformity with the laws of nature, for nature seems ravished by transmutation." According to Dobbs, Newton's alchemical thoughts were so securely established that he never came to deny their general validity, and in a sense, the whole of his career after 1675 may be seen as one long attempt to integrate alchemy and the mechanical philosophy. After the publication of the Principia, opponents declared that Newton's forces were in reality occult qualities. As Dobbs recognizes, in a certain sense, these critics were right. Newton's forces were very much like the hidden sympathies and antipathies found in much of the occult literature of the Renaissance period. But Newton had given forces an ontological status equivalent to that of matter and motion. By so doing, and by quantifying the forces, he enabled the mechanical philosophies to rise above the level of imaginary impact mechanisms. In analyzing the Newtonian conception of force, Richard Westfall arrives at the conclusion that modern science is the result of the wedding of the Hermetic tradition with the mechanical philosophy. In its spectacular flight, modern science has ignored or rejected the heritage of Hermeticism. Or, to put it differently, the triumph of Newtonian mechanics has ended up by annihilating its own scientific ideal. In effect, Newton and his contemporaries expected a different type of scientific revolution. In prolonging and developing the hopes and objectives, the first among these being the redemption of nature, of the neo-alchemist of the Renaissance, minds as different as those of Paracelsus, John Dee, Comenius, J.V. Andrée, Flood, and Newton saw in alchemy the model for a no less ambitious enterprise, the perfection of man by a new method of knowledge. In their perspective, such a method had to integrate into a non-confessional Christianity the Hermetic tradition and the natural sciences of medicine, astronomy, and mechanics. In fact, this synthesis constituted a new Christian creation comparable to the brilliant results obtained by the earlier integrations of Platonism, Aristotelianism, and Neoplatonism. This type of knowledge, dreamed of and partially elaborated in the 18th century, represents the last enterprise of Christian Europe that was undertaken with the aim of obtaining a total knowledge. Not precisely the last. Formulation of the idea that God might be known in material form meant positing the possibility that the highest conceivable value might be embodied concretely in matter, rather than in the established patriarchal spiritual world. This meant that the nature of God was something that could be made subject to material and thoughtful investigation. However, matter remained comparatively unknown to the medieval mind and was therefore contaminated with everything else unknown, repressed, and rejected. The assignment of value to matter was therefore attribution of value to unknown experience. This assignment was heretical because it implied the fallibility or incomplete nature of church dogma, the formalized medieval European general model of expectation and desire, and was therefore dangerous from the intrapsychic and the social viewpoints. Such heresy was compounded in severity because the church explicitly regarded matter, representative of the inadmissible unknown, as degraded, corrupt, imperfect, and demonic. The alchemist was an unredeemed, suffering man in search of an inexpressible ideal. He formulated that ideal and its process of generation using terms that referred to the physical world, at least from the modern perspective. However, the alchemist made no clear distinction between psychological and objective. His search for the ideal was therefore as much psychological as chemical. More, actually, since he worked in the absence even of the basic measurement devices of modern science. The alchemist posited that the answer lay outside the church in the unknown. Exploration of the unknown and forbidden meant generation of redemptive knowledge, then as it does now. Incorporation of such knowledge meant movement toward perfection. Broadly speaking, the alchemist wanted to transform every subordinate element in the category matter, the unknown, fallen, corrupt world, including man as material being, into the category gold, the Apollonian, spiritual, sun-like, incorruptible state. He was searching for a transformative agent to bring about that change, the lapis philosophorum, but also viewed himself as that agent, since he was integrally involved in the transformative opus of alchemy. This relatively straightforward conceptualization of movement toward the ideal is schematically presented in Figure 62, the alchemical opus as normal story. The alchemist courageously posited that the work of redemption held up as absolute by the church was not yet complete, or at least acted as if there was still work to be done. So he hoped to turn what was still unredeemed into gold. The problem is, of course, that turning base matter into gold is not possible as a normal act of movement from point A, the unbearable present, to point B, the desirable future. The attempt to produce the most ideal state possible, something akin to paradise on earth, is particularly unlikely without a revolution. So, the alchemical story rapidly turned into something more complex, something that essentially recapitulated the union of the gods, something like a process of initiation or spiritual transformation. The alchemist soon came to realize that movement toward the ideal did not mean an unbroken journey uphill. Soon came to realize that a large leap forward was necessarily preceded by a radical descent. Once the alchemist had decided to look into the unknown for salvation rather than to the church, or at least in addition to the church, he placed himself outside the protective confines of his previous system of classification. Outside that dogmatic system, things took on new meaning, or at least new potential meaning. Once you have decided that you don't know absolutely everything about something, it is possible to learn something new. However, when an object has been placed in a system of classification, within the constraints of a particular paradigm, its a priori motivational significance is constrained, entirely in the case of something deemed irrelevant, partially when the phenomenon is assigned a particular use. When the classification system fails, as a consequence of the transformation of the environment, natural or social, or more prosaically because of the emergence of incongruent experience, paradigm-threatening information, the phenomena previously constrained in their motivational significance regain their original status. That means that objects of experience are re-novelized, that the affect they were capable of producing prior to classification, re-emerges. This process was represented in the alchemical scheme by the death of the king, the previously reigning system of order, and the reappearance of the queen, the great mother, source of threat and promise, vital for renewal. The immersion of the king in the queen, their sexual union, the incest motif, symbolized reduction of the world to the pre-cosmogonic chaos preceding creation, to the state of prima materia, primal matter. This also led to the state of the warring opposites, to the re-emergence of conflicting substances once held in harmony by the preceding orderly condition. The reunion, symbolized as a creative or sexual union of king and queen, produced a state characterized by the possibility of something new. This something new might be conceptualized as the divine son emerging from that union, soon to be king again. This divine son was regarded variously as the new king, or even as the philosopher's stone itself in one of its many potential forms. This much more complex process of conceptualization, which accounts for the vast symbolic production of alchemy, is presented schematically in Figure 63, the alchemical opus as revolutionary story. The prima materia. It offers itself in lowly form. From it, their springs are eternal water. Carl Jung. The prima materia, alternatively, the round chaos or the alchemical Ouroboros, is the unknown as matter and simultaneously as effect upon imagination and behavior, inseparable pre-experimentally, is God as substance and effect of substance. The prima materia is the pre-cosmogonic egg, the dragon of chaos, the eternal source from which spirit and knowledge and matter and world arise. It is the unknown that simultaneously generates new phenomena when explored, the unknown that serves as the source of the information that comes to constitute the determinate experiencing subject. The alchemists therefore granted the prima materia a half-chemical, half-mythological definition. For one alchemist, it was quicksilver. For others, it was ore, iron, gold, lead, salt, sulfur, vinegar, water, air, fire, earth, blood, water of life, lapis, poison, spirit, cloud, dew, sky, shadow, sea, mother, moon, serpent. Jung states, the autonomy and everlastingness of the prima materia in Paracelsus, for example, suggests a principle equal to the deity corresponding to a dea mater. The following texts, for example, are applied to the prima materia, and his going forth is from the beginning, from the days of eternity, Micah 5:2, and before Abraham was made, I am, John 8:58. This is supposed to show that the stone is without beginning and has its primary existence from all eternity, and that it too is without end and will exist in all eternity. And in the same way, continues the author, that the stone together with its material has a thousand names and is therefore called miraculous, all these names can in eminent degree be predicated of God. And the author thereupon proceeds to this application. A Christian can hardly believe his ears. That from which things arise is the invisible and immovable God. The alchemists understood the prima materia to be as of yet unredeemed, however, and base. The notion of corrupted matter was a moral notion, and the imperfection of matter, therefore, a moral imperfection. The alchemists' reflections on the nature of this imperfect matter inevitably took the form of reflections upon the moral problem of imperfection and material corruption as such. Since the alchemist thought analogically and symbolically in the absence of the empirical method, he fantasized or imagined that the corrupt prima materia shared the characteristics of other corrupt and imperfect creations, including physical man, contaminated by original sin and his own transgressions. It is virtually impossible for us, as moderns, to realize the degree to which the universe of our forebears was a moral universe. Every aspect of that archaic world was engaged in moral endeavor, participating in corruption, striving toward perfection. Every ore wanted to be pure metal, every pure metal, gold. All smiths, miners, and alchemists were therefore serving the role of midwife, striving to help the earth bring forth the perfect substances it evidently desired to produce. Mircea Eliade states, with regard to the attitude characterizing the primitive metal worker, mineral substances shared in the sacredness attaching to the earth mother. Very early on, we are confronted with the notion that ores grow in the belly of the earth after the manner of embryos. Metallurgy thus takes on the character of obstetrics. Miner and metal worker intervene in the unfolding of subterranean embryology. They accelerate the rhythm of the growth of ores. They collaborate in the work of nature and assist it to give birth more rapidly. In a word, man, with his various techniques, gradually takes the place of time. His labors replace the work of time. To collaborate in the work of nature, to help her to produce at an ever-increasing tempo,